The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Deborah Love for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles that I've selected from a variety of academic sources. The first article is about our tonsils, and do we really need our tonsils? And this is from Popular Science and an article by Lauren Leffer. Humans have been taking our tonsils out for a remarkably long time. The first tonsil extractions date back thousands of years to at least early Hindu medicine practices and later to the Roman Empire. With the advance of surgical methods, tonsillectomies became commonplace in the 20th century. They were once so widely recommended that in 1921, a Manhattan hospital opened dedicated solely to performing the procedure in poor children. Wealthy donors funded the project under the belief that tonsil removal offered a universal benefit to the less fortunate. Though the tonsil hospital closed decades ago, tonsillectomies still remain one of the most prevalent childhood surgeries. By some assessments, rates have fallen since a peak in the 1970s. We're doing per 10,000 people probably 50% of what was done in the 1970s, Ron Mitchell, a pediatric otolaryngologist and professor at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, tells Popular Science. But still, about 290,000 tonsillectomies are performed in children under 15 years old in the U.S. each year, according to the 2019 Clinical Practice Guideline for Tonsillectomy in Children, which Mitchell co-authored. So why did doctors so frequently recommend tonsil removal? And why are we born with those fleshy lumps in the back of our throats in the first place, if they so often become problems? So let's look at what do tonsils do. Tonsils are organs of the immune system. They're made up of lymphoid tissue, similar to your lymph nodes, and contain infection-fighting white blood cells. Humans are born with four sets of tonsils that form a structure called Waldeyer's ring, where the nasal and oral cavities join at the back of the throat. The palatine tonsils, just behind the roof of the mouth, on either side of the uvula, are the largest of the group and the ones most often removed in surgery. The pharyngeal tonsils, or adenoids, are at the back of the nasal passage and are commonly taken out also. Additional tonsillar tissue sits at the base of the tongue and at the opening of your eustachian tubes. All four of these structures serve a very familiar, if not identical, function. Fahud Faraji, an otolaryngologist and medical researcher at the University of California, San Diego, tells Popular Science. The built-in redundancy is part of what mitigates the disruption of tonsillectomies, he explains. In the overwhelming majority of cases, some bits are left behind to pick up the slack. Normal, healthy tonsils play a role in immune system memory and local antibody production, speeding up your body's ability to fight off invaders near where they're most likely to enter the body, says Sidney Ramirez, an infectious disease physician and immunologist at UC San Diego. Tonsils contain a reservoir of T cells, B cells, macrophages, and neutrophils, all white blood cells with their own particular germ-fighting roles. T cells activate immune response and detect interlopers. B cells make antibodies that label problem particles for attack. macrophages and neutrophils engulf and eliminate pathogens and other debris. You have this set of immune cells that can fight off viruses and bacteria that don't have to travel very far and can surveil or provide protection as a first line of defense, said after ever-important mucus, Ramirez says. In her research, she found evidence that tonsils hold on to antiviral memory to combat repeat SARS-CoV-2 infections and other common bugs over the long term. But again, humans have a lot of redundancy, she adds. If tonsils are removed, the same diversity of immune cells is still present and circulating in the body. Thankfully, taking out one structure doesn't mean you're doomed. Why are some tonsils sometimes removed? Over time, as stats on tonsil removal have shifted, so too have the prevailing reasons for it. For decades, tonsillectomies were performed mostly to resolve frequent tonsillitis, an infection of the tonsils called by Streptococcus A bacteria. Strep throat is unpleasant for anyone, but in the subset of children who get recurrent tonsillitis, it can be especially uncomfortable, as bouts of swelling, fever, trouble swallowing, and serious pain come back again and again. Plus, strep infections that go untreated carry long-term risks and the potential for complications, like rheumatic fever, notes Ramirez. Yet improvements in antibiotic treatments and newer research indicating recurrent tonsillitis cases can recede with time mean that strep is no longer the major driver of tonsillectomy, Mitchell tells Popular Science. Over the last 20 years, there's been a big decrease in the number of tonsils removed for recurrent infection, he says. The 2019 guideline he helped write strongly recommends watching and waiting in response to repeated strep infections in most cases, instead of jumping straight to surgery. Now the biggest driver for tonsillectomies is to resolve breathing issues. In some children, the tonsils grow faster than the airways. That's when you get problems with snoring, mouth breathing, and sleep-disordered breathing, Mitchell says. Oversized tonsils can cause obstructive sleep apnea for certain kids, disrupting their ability to get proper rest for months or even years at a time during a window of crucial brain development, he explains. Again, in many cases, enough time and careful observation might reveal the problem solves itself as the airways catch up in size. However, for children with severe apnea symptoms, that wait might not be worth it. If children are struggling in school, not growing, developing behavioral issues, or asthma, then Mitchell and his guidelines co-authors recommend tonsillectomy, trading a week or two of painful recovery for months of breathing and sleeping difficulties. So, does tonsil removal carry any risks? As with any surgery involving general anesthesia, there is a risk of adverse allergic reaction. Bleeding post-surgery is another potential, though rare, short-term risk that can ultimately lead to additional surgery to patch up, Mitchell says. If pain isn't managed well enough in the aftermath, children might stop drinking fluids and become dehydrated, another possible complication. Then there's the debate over whether the longer-term consequences, about the long-term consequences of tonsil removal. Because they're immune organs, a spate of studies have examined whether those who've had their tonsils taken out end up with immunodifferences or deficiencies compared with those who haven't. The vast majority of research examining clinical markers of immune function, like white blood cell counts and antibody levels, finds no significant difference. Despite that, some large cohort studies have found that children who've had tonsillectomies or adenoidectomies show a small but significantly increased incidence of respiratory illness, including infections, allergies, autoimmune diseases, and asthma throughout their lives, compared to those with their tonsils intact. Other cohort-based research indicates an association between tonsillectomy and a slightly higher risk of multiple types of cancers. Yet the difficulty with all these cohort studies is that they cannot determine cause directly, only correlation, notes Ramirez. It's possible that tonsillectomy is linked to cancer risk because lymphoid tissues play a role in identifying and eliminating cancerous and precancerous cells early on. But it's also possible that people with recurrent tonsillitis or breathing issues in childhood were already predisposed to certain cancers and respiratory illnesses, or that having had your tonsils removed in childhood indicates something about your level of medical care access and exposure, perhaps making you more likely later to see a doctor for an infection or get diagnosed with cancer. We don't know, she says. What is clear is that removing tonsils is an effective and near immediate treatment for some children's breathing difficulties and a handful of kids' recurrent strep infections. In past decades, tonsillectomies were perhaps done without enough consideration of the cost versus benefit. Procedure rates varied more based on location than by actual clinical indicators of need. In one Vermont town, for instance, around 70% of children had their tonsils removed in the 1960s versus 20% in a neighboring municipality. Now, the guidelines for removal are standardized, and physicians tend towards a more cautious approach. We never take out tonsils for no indication, says Faraji, and where it is indicated, it's for good reason, he adds. There's always been concern about the overuse of surgery, says Mitchell, and it's important to ask those questions and consider the big picture. It should only be done when the benefits of surgery far outweigh the risks, he adds. The majority of children do not need a tonsillectomy. But when done for the right reasons, tonsillectomy offers a meaningful and quality of life boost. We have very happy families who will often say 1 month out, it's the best thing they ever did. This next article comes from UC San Francisco, University of California at San Francisco, and is getting a lot of notice in the popular press. They ask, do these two cancer drugs have what it takes to beat Alzheimer's? A new study finds FDA-approved drugs that reverse the gene expression signatures associated with Alzheimer's. Scientists at UC San Francisco and Gladstone Institutes have identified cancer drugs that promise to reverse the changes that occur in the brain during Alzheimer's, potentially slowing or even reversing its symptoms. The study first analyzed how Alzheimer's disease altered gene expression, the activity of genes in a cell, in single cells in the human brain. Then, researchers looked for existing drugs that were already approved by the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, and cause the opposite changes to gene expression. They were looking specifically for drugs that would reverse the gene expression changes in neurons and other types of brain cells called glia, all of which are damaged or altered in Alzheimer's disease. Next, the researchers analyzed millions of electronic medical records to show that patients who had took some of these drugs as part of their treatment for other conditions were less likely to get Alzheimer's disease. When they tested a combination of the two top drugs, both of which are cancer medications, in a mouse model of Alzheimer's, it reduced brain degeneration in the mice and even restored their ability to remember. Alzheimer's disease comes with complex changes to the brain, which has made it tough to study and treat. But our computational models opened up the possibility of tackling the complexity directly, said Marina Sirota, Ph.D., the interim director of the UCSF Bakar Computational Health Sciences Institute, professor of pediatrics, and co-senior author of the paper. We're excited that our computational approach led us to a potential combination therapy for Alzheimer's based on existing FDA-approved medications. The findings appeared in Cell on July 21st. The research was funded in part by the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation. Alzheimer's disease affects 7 million people in the U.S. and causes a relentless decline in cognition, learning, and memory. Yet decades of research have only produced two FDA-approved drugs, neither of which can meaningfully slow the decline. Alzheimer's is likely the result of numerous alterations in many genes and proteins that, together, disrupt brain health, says Yadong Wang, MD, PhD, senior investigator, and director of the Center for Translational Advancement at Gladstone, professor of neurology and pathology at UCSF, and co-senior author of the paper. This makes it very challenging for drug development, which traditionally produces one drug for a single gene or protein that drives disease. The team took publicly available data from three studies of the Alzheimer's brain that measured single-cell gene expression in brain cells from deceased donors with or without Alzheimer's disease. They used this data to produce gene expression signatures for Alzheimer's disease in neurons and glia. The researchers compared these signatures with those found in the connectivity map, a database of results from testing the effects of thousands of drugs on gene expression in human cells. Out of 1,300 drugs, 86 reversed the Alzheimer's disease gene expression signature in one cell type, and 25 reversed the signature in several cell types in the brain. But just 10 had already been approved by the FDA for use in humans. Lee, Wong, and Sirota chose two cancer drugs out of the top five candidates for laboratory testing. They predicted one drug, letrozole, would remedy Alzheimer's in neurons, and another, irinotecan, would help glia. Letrozole is usually used to treat breast cancer. Irinotecan is usually used to treat colon and lung cancer. The team used a mouse model of aggressive Alzheimer's disease with multiple disease-related mutations. As the mice aged, symptoms resembling Alzheimer's emerged, and they were treated with one or both drugs. The combination of the two cancer drugs reversed multiple aspects of Alzheimer's in the animal model. It undid the gene expression signatures in neurons and glia that had emerged as the disease progressed. It reduced both the formation of toxic clumps of proteins and brain degeneration, and importantly, it restored memory. It's so exciting to see the validation of the computational data in a widely used Alzheimer's mouse model, Wang said. He expects the research to advance soon to clinical trial so the team can directly test the combination therapy in Alzheimer's patients. If completely independent data sources, such as single-cell expression data and clinical records, guide us to the same pathways and the same drugs, and then resolve Alzheimer's in a genetic model, then maybe we're onto something, Sirota says. We're hopeful this can be swiftly translated into a real solution for millions of patients with Alzheimer's. This next article was published in The Guardian, and I know that's not a recognized medical journal, but they do report on medical research, and I just thought this was really a fun article. It notes owning dog or cat could preserve some brain functions as we age, study says. As global population ages and dementia rates climb, scientists may have found an unexpected ally in the fight against cognitive decline. Cats and dogs may be exercising more than just your patience. They could be keeping parts of your brain tickling over, too. In a potential breakthrough for preventive health, researchers have found that owning a four-pawed friend is linked to slower cognitive decline by potentially preserving specific brain functions as we grow older. Interestingly, the associations differ depending on the animal. Dog owners were found to retain sharper memory, both immediate and delayed, while cat owners showed slower decline in verbal fluency. When it comes to slower cognitive decline in their owners, however, it seems that all pets are not created equal. Fish and birds, while charming companions, showed no significant link. Pet ownership has been linked to a positive influence on cognitive functioning and cognitive decline in late adulthood, said Adriana Rostakova, a researcher and lead author of the article, which was published in the journal Scientific Reports. However, there is limited understanding of how different species of pets are associated with these outcomes. Rostakova, who works at the Lifespan Developmental Psychology Research Group at the University of Geneva, used data from 8 waves of the Survey of Health and Retirement in Europe to examine the relationship between pet ownership and cognitive decline over an 18-year period among adults aged 50 and older. She specifically looked at the distinct role of owning dogs, cats, birds, and fish. The key novelty of our study was that we found notable difference between the species, she said. Rostakova hypothesized that because keeping fish or birds showed no meaningful link to changes in cognitive decline, the overall pattern of pet ownership may be driven primarily by having a cat or dog rather than pet ownership in general. Several explanations may help explain the absence of this association in fish and bird owners, despite the reports of their ownership ownership's positive influence on well-being in ways that are usually associated with cognitive benefits, she added. A fish or bird's short lifespan may potentially limit the level of emotional connection one is able to develop with the pet fish, she said. Bird ownership may negatively affect the owner's sleep quality due to increased noise levels, which has been shown to be associated with cognitive decline. Rostakova added, "It is further possible that the interaction with dogs and cats provides unique cognitive stimulation, which may be less pronounced in other, less demanding pets." Other research has found evidence of an increase in prefrontal brain activation and stronger attentional processes and emotional arousal caused by interaction with a dog. There is further evidence of increased activation of prefrontal cortex and the inferior frontal gyrus when interacting with cats, which is speculated to be linked to the characteristic, hard-to-predict temperament of the animal. There is also a possibility of increased social stimulation facilitated by cats and dogs, which may be linked to the slower cognitive decline experienced by their owners, an increased frequency of social interactions when accompanied by a dog, or for cats, a substitute for a social network, says Rostakova. As the NHS grapples with an aging population and rising dementia rates, experts say the findings could reshape how we think about healthy aging and the animals we choose to age alongside. Andrew Scott, the author of The Longevity Imperative and a cat owner, although also a dog lover, said, "We tend to think of health as being about disease and hospitals, but as we live longer and need to focus on preventive measures that keep us healthy for longer, we will discover that the health system extends well beyond doctors and hospitals. It is about how we live our life. What is nice about this study is it suggests a fun and meaningful way of keeping healthy and engaged. A lot of things we are recommended to do for our health aren't always fun or companionable. Having a pet can be fun, and if it keeps you healthy, that's a great bonus. Now here's a brief news article from the Harvard Health Letter. It says physical activity of any intensity is tied to lower cancer risk. Being active each day at any pace might help you reduce your risk for cancer, according to a study published March 26, 2025, in the British Journal of Sports Medicine. The research involved more than 85,000 people at an average age of 63 who wore activity trackers for 1 week and were followed for 6 years. Compared with people who were least active, those who were most active, even if they were simply doing light intensity activities such as errands, had a 20% lower risk for 13 types of cancer, such as colon or breast cancer. Likewise, people who took the most daily steps had reduced cancer risks. For example, the risk was 16% lower in people who took 9,000 steps per day compared with people who took 5,000 steps per day. The study was observational and doesn't prove that physical activity staves off cancer. However, many studies focusing on vigorous physical activity have suggested that exercise reduces cancer risk. This study is the first to suggest that light or leisurely activity might have similar outcomes. And lastly, this brief from Harvard says, fasting versus calorie restrictions for weight loss, which one wins? If you're tired of counting calories to lose weight, you might consider a style of intermittent fasting called 4.3. It allows you to eat normally on 4 days of the week and eat very little fast on the other 3 days, which can be spread throughout the week. This approach might even help you lose more weight than counting calories, notes a small randomized controlled trial published May 20th, 2025 in the Annals of Internal Medicine. The study involved 165 people, average age of 42, who were divided into two groups. One group followed a 4.3 intermittent fasting plan, eating only 20% of their usual calories on fasting days. The other group reduced their daily calorie intake by 34%. After 1 year, people in the 4.3 group had lost more weight, an average of about 6 more pounds than the people in the calorie-restricted group. Well, that's all we have time for today. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Deborah Love, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, NorthCarolinaReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.